This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 50. Yay! We made it to 50. Somebody early on told me that most podcasters, I think the average podcasters quit about 7 episodes. So I feel like 50 is quite an accomplishment, and I could not have done it without all of you. And I truly and honestly mean that. This has been a very special project for me. I didn't know what would happen. And the feedback and the emails from all over the world have just been amazing. And it just inspires me to keep going and bringing you interesting ideas, voices, perspectives. And I hope you, and I get a sense that you're tuning into it and sharing it with your friends and colleagues, et cetera, students. So thank you for all that. We're at episode number 50, and this is a special one. It's a great one. I think you're going to really like it. We have Lynn Rosen. We're going to be talking about embodying conversations, somatic practices, the body, narrative therapy, just really interesting conversation about all these kinds of ideas. So before we do that, really quick, what do I want to say? Oh, I'm presenting. I just want to do a little plug. I got a couple plugs. First one, I'm at the Denver Pomo Gathering, October 13th or 12th, Saturday. I should know that. But go to the Facebook. Go to the Facebook. I'm calling it the Facebook. And Google Denver Pomo Gathering. It'll come up. You'll get all the information. I'm doing narrative therapy with families, and I'm bringing some co-research I did with some families. I'm bringing some videos of a few families that I worked with talking about what it was like, the narrative perspective, working with a narrative therapist, and also what they think works best in family therapy. And I think And I'll also be talking about some ideas I have about how to, you know, ethically work with families. And then you'll see some video that I've got of some families that we did some co-research together. So, and I think it's really special, and these families are really special to me. And so I want to share that with you, and I'm looking forward to doing that. So that's the Pomo Denver Pomo Gathering. Other great speakers as well. It's going to be a lot of great content. So look out for that. If you're anywhere near Denver, please come say hello. I'd appreciate it. And for those of you that are waiting for t-shirts on the 50th episode, I know there's several that have been waiting a while. I actually have some free time coming up. It's been crazy. Month, but I have a couple, I got some free time coming up, and I will be getting shirts out. And if you would like a t-shirt, a Radical Therapist t-shirt, or some stickers to spread the word, just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com, and I will get that stuff out to you. And I've started this new thing. I started with the last episode, but I'm doing a spotlight on reviews, iTunes reviews. And in honor of our 50th episode, I'm going to share Anissa's review. I think I got that right, Anissa. Hopefully I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Anissa's review, which happened on September 24th of 2018. And Anissa writes, this podcast was extremely instrumental in helping me when I was a trainee to stick with narrative ideas long enough to understand them, love them, and incorporate them into my life and practice. Dr. Chris Hoff and his guests helped me to understand that there are different ways to show up in this work, honor the great thinkers who came before, and bring my authentic self to family therapy. For that, I am eternally grateful. Keep going and keep doing great things. Thank you for you and your contributions. Anissa, thank you very much. I think that's a wonderful spotlight on the review to share for our 50th episode. Thank you for that. So if you would like to help out the show and or be on a spotlight for a review, please go to iTunes, rate and review the show. And who knows, you might be a spotlight for review. So, okay, I think I've done it. I think that's it. So let's get right to the show. And like I said, I'm really excited. We're going to be talking to Lynn Rosen. And Lynn is a LCSW based in Los Angeles who has been practicing therapy for over 28 years and found her way to narrative therapy, her philosophical home, in the early 90s. For many years, she was core faculty and director of the Postmodern Therapy Training Program at PGI and founder of WPLA, Women's Project Los Angeles. She continues to enjoy teaching, training, and supervision in many contexts. She aims to stay close to the message of her favorite African proverb, until lions have historians, tales of hunting will always glorify the hunter, believing that in bringing forward lions' tales, stories, and experiences at the margins, there is wisdom and knowledge that can transport us all. She's working to create bridges, both practically and philosophically, between narrative therapy, IPNB, EMDR, and somatic therapies in her work, and with those living with the effects of trauma and other difficulties that are corrosive of relational lives. Lynn is reauthoring Teaching Faculty and Board, where she looks forward to collaborating with narrative practice enthusiasts around the world. So without further ado, let's meet Lynn. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to The Radical Therapist.
Hi, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, thank you for making the time. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, and it's happening now, and I'm excited about that. And you've actually been a guest on the show in the past, a while back at a postmodern therapy gathering in LA, really briefly. But now, and ever since then, I've wanted to try to get you on here to really go a little more in depth about the work that you're doing. So I'm really appreciative that you made the time to talk to us and our audience. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks, Chris. I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm delighted to be here.
Awesome. Okay, so let's get rolling. I guess my first question, I'm always curious, is could you start by telling us a bit about your background and how you came to narrative therapy?
So I started my career in clinical social work. I was working in residential treatment in Philadelphia, reunifying children and families, and really learned about systems and what folks in the margins were up against, the intersections of race, power, class. And one of my clients, a couple years in, was a young boy. He disclosed being abused by a house parent at the treatment center. So it was a major upheaval. I had to prepare him to go to trial. The director was fired for the sexist treatment of staff. So I was very much the whistleblower early in my career. And then left and went to a feminist-informed treatment center, the Renfrew Center in Philadelphia. And at that point, became very interested in the work out of the Stone Center, challenging male models of development. And there, Chris, there was movement therapy, art therapy, psychodrama. I did a satire-like family sculpting group. We had art therapy, so it takes me way back. So working with experiences outside the spoken word or text have always been held close at hand. At the time, I was sharing an office with Debbie Zucker. Her brother is Larry Zucker, who you've interviewed on the show. Yes. And through Debbie, we heard Larry talk about, you have to go hear Michael White at the Ackerman Institute in New York and David Epstein. So we traveled to New York together, and I truly found home. These ideas politically and personally resonated with me. And we were fortunate to be in a kind of treatment center where we could experiment and bring these ideas to the center. So we were able to create open charts for clients at Renfrew where they could read their files. We had groups where they could voice ideas about the program and speak back to their treatment team. So it was a really generative time for me.
And that you were doing some progressive stuff probably a long time ago, right?
A long time ago. And there were other influences I'd like to mention. One at a Renfrew Center Foundation conference, I went to hear Catherine Steiner Adair, and she was talking about her research with adolescent and pre-adolescent girls, and they were coding language. And what she talked about that I've never forgotten, and it really ties into my interest in embodiment and these ideas that I've taken up, is that early on, she heard the language of girls saying, "I know." They would just talk about their experiences in this honest and forthcoming way. And fast forward a few years later, when the girls became a little older, the language shifted to, "Well, I don't know. I don't know." And then fast forward a few years later, and the language shifted to, "Well, you know, you know." So the "I who knows" went to the "I who doesn't know." It went to the "I who thinks you know better." And she talked about, this is how girls go underground in the culture, through this disembodiment. So personally and professionally, I mean, I have chills talking about that. I think self-care and embodiment are radical acts and really vital to navigating life's complexities. If we're going to live into our intentions and purposes and values and beliefs, preferences, I feel like we need bodies that are resonant with all aspects of the world around us. And one of the most profound poetic voices is the voice for me of Audre Lorde, the prolific Black lesbian poet and civil rights activist. And she spoke to women, you know, and I really learned how I too was trained to fear the knowledge of my body. She said, "The white father told us, I think, therefore I am. The Black mother within each of us, the poet whispers in our dreams, I feel, therefore I can be free. For within living structures defined by profit, by linear power, by institutional dehumanization, our feelings were not meant to survive. Kept around as unavoidable adjuncts or pleasant pastimes, feelings were expected to kneel to thought as women were expected to kneel to men."
Wow.
So she's been, and that's from Sister Outsider, one of my favorite books that has influenced my life politically and personally.
It's powerful. Okay, I have a big question for you, I guess, to get us kind of started on the path. And narrative therapy, at least in my mind, has seemed to be weary of talking about or taking up conversations about the body. And I'm assuming this is kind of out of fear of being accused of being essentialist or something, but you've leaned into this exploration, and I'm wondering if you could speak to how you've integrated these ideas both practically and philosophically in a way that supports the social construction of identities and the politics of experience while escaping recruitment into interiority ideas and binaries of body, mind, inside, outside, thinking and feeling, and resources and deficits, et cetera. I'm wondering if you could say more about how you're doing that.
Sure, Chris. So when I was faculty at a graduate school, I was directing a postmodern therapy program. There was a professor, Dr. Joan Rosenberg, who's now at Pepperdine. And she was very interested in interpersonal neurobiology and those tenets. So I was curious about this cultural story that was so pervasive. So I started studying the work of Stephen Porges, Dan Siegel, polyvagal theory, Bessel van der Kolk, Body Keeps the Score. You know, and even though earlier on when I was at the Renfrew Center, I was very weary of EMDR, thinking, concerned about re-traumatization, concerned about promoting interiority ideas, I started exploring somatic therapies, so the work of Pat Ogden, Peter Levine. And philosophically, I was worried about supporting interiority, kind of as Kenneth Gergen, the relational constructionist thinker, would say, bounded being ideas. I didn't want to go naturalistic. We see this certainly politically right now, kind of with different masculinity discourse being played out day by day. And cause I wasn't interested in causality claims. So different brain parts account for brain states. And of course, kind of Cartesian dualisms that are very much prevalent in the field, kind of binaries such as, like you said, body, mind, thinking, feeling, resource deficit. So the last thing I wanted was for anyone to locate PTSD and trauma inside persons needing repair, obscuring the operation of violence, abuse, and neglect. But at the same time, Chris, I was troubled by the way, for many clients, sensations were cast as the enemy, that the body became the enemy.
Right.
And early in my work with women with eating problems, realize what are the effects of cutting off spontaneities, of sensation, of hungers, and, you know, feeling that embodiedness and a fullness of experience was important to relational well-being. So in wrestling with these tensions, Kenneth Gergen's work was very helpful because I started to think about sensations, images, and memories as constructed in relationship but held privately. So the brain might make it possible to live into experience, but it doesn't make experiences intelligible. It doesn't contribute to meaning making. So how do we hold, though, the habits of the body that tell important relational stories? And we're not searching for something in there. We're looking at contextual, not causal. Hmm. And how do we create a different kind of scaffolding for movement toward a sense of aliveness, creativity, imagination, and agency, and a kind of work that makes space for the emergence of moral judgment, not normalizing judgment. So for me, this is all in service of moving toward relational being, not self-contained individualism. So for example, I'm not interested in brain parts and how they fire. I'm interested in holding all of this metaphorically and how this shapes discernment around pacing, around moving between the landscapes of narrative, somatic work, and EMDR. I can remember back when I was at the graduate school, Tom Anderson, the late Norwegian psychiatrist, would come speak. And he so beautifully talked about the physicality of all language, body, habits, and gestures that tell relational stories, stories of resistance, responses to trauma. I remember he would give language to gestures. He was telling a story of a woman cutting, and he asked the hand that held the blade, what was that hand saying? And then he asked about the arm that was being cut. And what was that saying? What was the story? So there were
that's beautiful.
These threads that have really stayed with me.
Yeah. Okay, there's a, just kind of continuing on that, there's a lot of talk about the affective turn in psychology, and I'm wondering if you could say something about that. That's pretty prominent right now, so I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Yeah, you know, I want to acknowledge the work of Dr. Gerald Monk, a professor at San Diego State Marriage and Family Therapy Counseling and School Program, Psychology Program. He really inspired me. He took up an interest in my work and very much inspired me to look into more academic writing about the affective turn. This is a little bit about what he's writing about. And what I found in that literature is that some of the work turns back and revisits the work of Spinoza, Deleuze, and Guattari. So Mizumi in The Politics of Affect, for example, talks about Spinoza making a distinction between emotional and affect. And affect, he talks about this interest in how we affect and how we are affected by others. And that this intensity of affect leads to a degree of freedom that opens up a living in an embodied way and a heightened sense of belonging. Deleuze talks about needing to believe in the world. Meaning, that meaning is not about the world, but our lived experience in it, and openness to the world. I love this response-able, that we're able to respond to the world, and that this is a process of becoming, a sense of aliveness that can happen in connection. And then there's other work that was more aligned with anthropology, challenging binaries, like the work of Sarah Ahmed, where she developed this cultural kind of theory, politics of emotion. So really talked about the intersection of language, bodies, emotion, while attending to gender, class, race, sexuality, and nation. So, and for example, she talks about the dominance of fear in modern times and how is that used to justify policies or sway opinion. But what I found, Chris, is that this movement in the affective turn, what is absent is attention to the construction of emotions that are nonverbal and non-conscious. And I think that this is the territory that is most impacted by trauma. Wittgenstein kind of hints at, which I love, he hints at experience and puns and a feel for things. And as we know, he challenges the pursuit of truth as a kind of casualty of rhetorical warfare,
right,
and invites us to speak hesitantly, humbly, and poetically, or not at all. So I think integrative work restores a sense of uncertainty, because often uncertainty is coupled with fear, so that we can bumble, slow down, listen to the welling up of sensation, have space for poetic and improvisation, instead of prematurely coming to meaning making. So this is kind of my hope, is that we're moving toward an effective discursive turn, and I'm curious as to what this might make possible.
So from that lens, how do you conceptualize trauma and its effects?
You know, there's different frames that guide my work and how I move between talk therapy, EMDR, kinds of work, and somatic therapies. You know, I really value the narrative approach in working with the effects of trauma. Michael White talked about half stories, right, that there's stories that happen to people, but there's the stories that often are picked up about the responses to trauma. So I always start here with a narrative. How do we make visible the operation of violence? How do we deconstruct culturally held stories and socio-political contexts that keep them alive? I love the idea of, which has been so central in my work, as distress as tribute to what one gives value to, what one holds to be precious that has been taken away, threatened, or degraded. And this so speaks to someone's intentions, hopes, purposes, values, and beliefs in life. So I want to honor sites and mediums for healing that are culturally relevant for clients. And I feel like the talk therapy part, it can restore memory and bring forward context and agency and help move things from implicit to explicit. And I also found, Chris, that sometimes there just aren't words for experiences, that there's a whole range of experiences that were left out of the therapy room, that were telling an important story, that were openings. So I might have someone sitting in the office across from me, and while we're talking, that clients have an experience of dissociation, of moving, associating to something else, moving away from the conversation. And without words, that invites shame and a sense of confusion and alienation. So even before formal training, I started playing with, you know, what is helpful for clients consulting me when they're losing a sense of presence. Do we sit on the floor? Is touch used appropriately helpful? Do I avert my gaze while we're having a conversation? That has a huge impact, or change where I'm sitting and negotiate orientation. So, you know, it had me thinking about that without a visceral sense of safety, does change and learning really happen if people are in a survival-based response to a trauma, that it's exhausting to maintain that? And a client of mine once said, it's a surviving in life lifestyle, not a thriving in life lifestyle. So, you know, I imagine that it's very, if we ignore the body's signals, it's really difficult to navigate confusion. And do we need our full bodies to navigate the demands in life? So this had me really move toward exploring these alternate modalities and kind of see how I could integrate them philosophically and practically.
Great. Can you tell me a little bit more about those frames that guide discernment for you?
Yeah, there's a few. One is memory theory. I just want to say, when I think about memory, I think of it as a politically and relationally for a construct, not that I'm capturing any kind of true story in memory. So before Michael White died, he was returning to the work of Lev Vygotsky, the Soviet psychologist who died in 1934. I think in the 50s, his work started to reemerge. And the work of Russell Mears, a psychiatrist from Australia. And their work was focused on talking about traumatic memory. So Vygotsky talks about the zone of proximal development, that in learning, there's a gap between where children are, their level, and what is capable, what is possible to learn. And as they develop, first they observe responses from caregivers, which shape meaning. They learn facts about the world, routines. There's a development of a frame of reference. This moves into symbolic play, abstraction, a differentiation between what's real and not real. And children learn a sense of myself across time. And they're able then to kind of construct concepts. And this, of course, leads to narrative construction. What Vygotsky and Mears were saying, or what I gleaned, was that memory develops from unconscious to conscious, and trauma may interrupt this. And I started seeing how this is reflected in stories that clients were telling me. So many clients come in, Chris, and tell trauma, their trauma stories as a chronicle or a fact. But there's a loss of complexity, and there's no language for inner life. There's some clients where there's a real disconnection between what is real and not real. Some might know that a story has happened, but the context disappears from view. I noticed with clients a losing of a reference point that impacts agency and diminishes curiosity. So the way stories are told to me are speaking to the effects of trauma. So I listen for that. The other two frames that guide my work, one is Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory. And to say this very briefly, the idea is we go to the relationship first, help. Is somebody there? Engagement. This helps with modulating arousal. When that doesn't work, our bodies kick in to fight and flight. UCLA realized that this is very gendered, that actually women also kind of engage in tend and befriending. And if this is thwarted and people feel trapped, there's a freeze response and shutdown. So the significance of this for me is I am holding, and this comes from interpersonal neurobiology, kind of one of these metaphors that I find are useful, this idea of a window of tolerance, that people are in a zone of resiliency. I don't believe in fragile clients. People have always taken up incredible skills and know-how when they're up against horrible oppression. But sometimes those repertoires can become small. And so I am always looking for, are people moving beyond some window of tolerance? So do people move into hyperarousal up here, or do people move into collapse and shutdown? Because I do think it's hard to move out of survival mode if we're in those places. And those are times, Chris, where I feel like clients, if somebody's in hyperarousal, collapse and shutdown, you know, there's something that isn't sticking outside of the therapy room, even if we have these great deconstructive conversations. So we all develop strategies to protect ourselves in the face of danger. And I think so much energy gets tied up in this. But sensation for some folks are often paired with danger. So one way I create scaffolding is by working with these implicit somatic narratives, pre-language. So I slow down and I invite sustained awareness, like a witnessing position. So together, we're going to just put some space around these immediate experiences. And I'm not engaging in thinking. I'm engaging in a noticing and observing. So I liken it to loitering in narrative therapy. So we're hanging around something, interrupt habits like numbness or overriding needs or bracing. And so when we slow it down, we can track and research what is happening in the body, what sensation, the moment before someone comes to a conclusion like, I'm a failure, there's something happening. And when we work with that moment and put space around it and work with somebody to track it and see what comes next, and the client is leading, we're going with their local knowledge of the body, This allows space for discovery and curiosity. And something unique is going to unfurl. And these openings for me lead to shifts in meaning making and new possibilities to respond to people in the world, to their experiences. I have a client I'm thinking about who really took apart his experience of racing in life, horrific trauma growing up. And he developed a sense of confidence in navigating kind of his internal life that was getting in the way of relationship. And one profound effect I think it had that some of this nonlinear work has is that people can discern the difference between discomfort and danger, between past and present. There's space to notice acts of resistance. And there's the ability to stay in not knowing, which I think is often frightening when people are living with the effects of trauma. So together, how do we thicken these moments in the not knowing space where imagination and agency emerges? And when people are in more extreme hyperarousal or shutdown, I'm really going to pay attention to the senses, hearing, smell, touch, taste, intuition. So for example, a client of mine, her body was starting to curl into a ball, and I asked her to look outside the window and describe in exquisite detail what she was noticing. And as she was doing this, Chris, I asked her, you know, was she noticing anything in her body? And she said that it started to calm down. She started to regain a sense of presence. And then later in the session, I noticed she was looking at her sneaker, and I asked about that. And she said, oh, I was looking on the details on my shoe. That she started to find ways to work with her body.
You brought up imagination, and I understand that you do access imagination, and something you call a kind of double seeing, which is related to maybe double listening in your work. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think the EMDR type of work. I do EMDR with bilateral stimulation. So clients are holding fuzzies that go back and forth between the left hand and the right hand. So I think trauma impacts visualization that's needed to see our past metaphorically. Russell Mears talks about that. And when we integrate this nonlinear work, I think it restores visualizations. There's new associations between memories that weren't ordinarily accessed. We move outside the familiar, and it's not linear. You don't have to edit it. It doesn't have to make sense. And I think in this, there's openings for reauthoring and remembering practices. So I started calling it like a re-looking or a double seeing. So one is seeing images in a context. People see trauma, but they also are seeing their responses to trauma. But what's interesting in this work that engages the imagination is they're seeing from different angles, different perspectives. There's also this dual focus of attention. So, and I remember years ago, Vygotsky talking about how children distance from the immediacy of their experiences so they can more radically engage. I think through this nonlinear work, there's the distancing from the immediacy of experiences so they can be present to suffering with me. Or sometimes people bring in an imagined community of support, or what I'm recently coining a moral outreach team, while exploring the history. So they're bringing people in, they're populating identities with these imagined allies. Sometimes I use and this is typical in the EMDR work, you use a distancing metaphor before you start. So people might be having this experience looking at it on a hilltop or on the bank of a river, and these images are moving through. Or as a movie, and they have the remote, and they could turn down the volume or stop or pause or fast forward. Or some are seeing it through double pane glass where they feel there's more protection. I think this also supports this kind of linear work because you're working with time in a collapsed way, past, present, imagined, future. So people start, I feel like there's temporal shifts where folks will say this happened to me in the past. I've had clients become activists in the imagination. So one client who experienced sexual abuse went to the judge in her imagination and told the judge on the loudspeaker to announce to all the children in the town, you know, that they would not be safe with her abusers. So this imagery, Chris, I think supports intentionality. You can act and you can have allies act. One effect of this, I think responsibility is assigned where it belongs, and it truly invites a sense of compassion. So the client is organically moving toward healing, and we're getting out of the way and trusting this and just developing scaffolding. Rebecca Solnit said, our humanity is made up of stories, or in the absence of words and narratives, out of imagination.
So I guess my next question is, what have been your clients' experiences of this integrative work?
So I brought a short transcript and I brought client voices. So Okay. Whenever I talk about my work, I want insider knowledges, you know, insiders to really speak to what's helpful. So I want to tell you about working with Kate. She left a very chaotic home at the age of 13. She was out on her own in a large city. By 18, she bought a rundown row house and she made it into her home and was taking care of a dying mother. Her sister left the house when she was 13 years old. So her sister recently, this is many years later, they're adults now, was diagnosed with cancer, and her sister was clear that she's needing space and she wasn't hearing back and felt very triggered by this. So we started doing EMDR work, and she said, I'm not hearing back. I feel cut off. I feel punished. She's angry with me. I'm at fault. I'll always be on the outside. I try so hard. Nothing I do works. I feel sadness, frustration, futility, and helplessness. So I asked her to float back in time, earliest, strongest memory. She came up with an image. I'm 9 years old. I'm in front of the house. I'm on the top of a small hill. And then we just started the bilateral, going back and forth, left, right, and she was in her imagination. And we have periods where she's in her imagination, then she'd stop and tell me a little bit. And I'm just gonna read a little bit of what she said in between these segments. She said, I see my sister walking home. I run to her, but she laughs and dismisses me. She's 13, she tells me to go home. I look back and she's gone. I walk into the house, I don't know what to do. Should I turn on the TV, walk in the kitchen, the dining room? I'm thinking about where my sister is. She's gone. She's never coming back, just gone. I can't imagine this, but I know she's never going to be home again. My protector from my father is gone. She was my way into a different world outside of the family. Ideas, music, another way of seeing the world. I don't think I realized how much I looked up to her. I'm going outside to see if she's coming back. All the fun got drained away, all the possibilities. I'm on the front step. I don't know what to do. So the work was, she was a bit stuck in that image. And I asked her, so what do you think the 9-year-old might need? And she said, someone else to be home, someone to pay attention to her. I asked, so who could do that, Kate? And after a long pause, she said, I want to bring my sister back. She's telling, so in her imagination, this is what unfolded. She's telling her boyfriend to go home. She needs to spend some time with me. She has an album underneath her arm. It's B.B. King. She wants to play it for me. We're listening to music together. I never heard anything like it before. We're dancing together. And then even though she's not coming home physically, she told me she'll be thinking about me. She tells me that I'll always be with her and she'll always be with me. She reassures me that Dad will not hurt me, that I know what to do. She sighs. She can be like the stick. When he's angry, just hold up the stick. That is what she does. It's green, 3.5 feet. She told me how to hold it at an angle. Then she starts playing it like an air guitar, and I imitate what she's doing. My father comes home. He looks at us and what we're up to. I hold the stick up and he just goes upstairs. We both lay down on the ground and hold hands. She sighs. Is there anything you notice now? I asked. She said, it's completed. The image is gone. I feel relaxed. There's not much of a charge. I don't have much emotion around it now. So I go back to the image of her sister not texting her back. And she said, I don't feel energy around it. When she's not texting me back, she still hears me like a message in a bottle. I know she's taking it in. She feels my love. Love is not dependent on texting back. It just is. It doesn't mean that I love her any less. There was nothing I did to her to have her act that way. It's just how she copes. She told me that, this. So I asked for reflections about what was helpful about this work, that session. I trust that it goes where it needs to go, she says. I'm surprised where it went back to. It's like a creative process, like starting to write something. It opens up the world, not so literal, expansive. You go beyond the facts of the story. Life was hard. My sister abandoned me. My mother got sick and died. It gets at the purity. Things were fucked up. She became my everything, and my everything left. It helped me step outside of good and bad positioning. I think not talking frees us from the storyline. Staying in the story would have just had me feel more entrenched, more in themes, not the plot. I brought my sister back and put words to what could not be spoken. The stick was protection, but also a connection to each other. We danced with it. We were both captured by tyrannies of the past. And then I asked a narrative-inspired question. I wonder what you imagine it would be like if your sister knew the ways that you were carrying her with you. She got teary. She said, maybe I will tell her. I watched her leave, and then I could leave. I never thought about that, that she was modeling something for me that helped me to leave at 13. We were both trying to escape the tyrannies, but my sister learned to pit siblings against each other as a way to survive. I can take this to all relationships. I don't have to be swayed by others. I can have a stance. I know what I feel and what I believe, and I can hold on to that.
Wow. So, thank you for sharing that.
I have some other voices of clients. I don't know how we're doing with time, but...
Well, I guess I do have a question. That was nice, but I'm wondering, how do you envision this work moving forward, or what hurdles might there be, and what are the possibilities?
Well, I think the hurdles, Chris, is that I get concerned that people learn any of this as a technique and not as a philosophical stance that guides practices. And I also worry, especially with therapists who are more green, that it's supporting a kind of eclecticism that concerns me. I'm not interested in promoting that. Mm. I'd much prefer somebody who has eyes in one place, and they're trying to kind of work toward practices that align with that.
Right.
So, yeah, those are definitely the concerns. You know, in terms of possibilities, I was reading a piece about Foucault, and in this article they were going back to Merleau-Ponty and talking about the body as an active co-constitutor of the world, that while the body is, you know, can escape being affected by power relations that are inscribed on it, it's not passive. And it can push up against these and find a way to wrestle. And to me, this is an incredible site for an opening for agency and resistance. And in a book that I read that informed some of what I said today, it's called Intelligence in the Flesh by Claxton. He asks, what effect would it have to consider ourselves an embodied and extended system? And if this became part of our lived experience, not just words, what difference would it make for the social world, institutions, and practices? So thinking about embodied politics, embodied religion, embodied medicine. Mm. So my hope is that integrative work and an effective discursive turn, that this is a step in that direction.
Right. I'm thinking of the term, I saw somewhere, informed integration is what you were talking, integrative work. Like you said, having one eyes on one kind of what did you say, philosophy or?
That, you know, I worry about people having eyes in one place and their work everywhere else, you know, that how are we clear about our eyes are here? These are philosophical assumptions and tenets that are important to me. And 60% of the time, my practices are staying within that. Yeah. Right. And then I'm doing good work. You know, that's what I aspire to. Right. And so I worry about a kind of eclecticism or kind of moving toward technique that loses connection with the philosophy and stances that truly guide the work.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so I know people listening to this are going to want to know more, and they're going to, I'm sure, be excited about the work you're doing. And so how would they find you? What upcoming workshops do you have? What trainings are coming up? And everybody, I'll link this stuff in the show notes as well. So
great. Thanks, Chris. So I have a practice in Larchmont and Hancock Park at L. Rosen at larchmontassociates.com. I also opened up an office in Pasadena. So that's where I do my clinical work. I'm faculty as part of Reauthoring Teaching, which is a great kind of online collaboratory that offers salons and workshops, higher education, trainings, and consultation groups. So starting in January, I'll be doing a 6-month training group, an embodying conversations group, as well as a consultation group. And coming up on October 12th and October 13th, October 12th is a full day, and October 13th, we end at 1, so it's a day and a half workshop. San Diego State Marriage and Family Therapy Counseling and School Psychology Program, Professor Gerald Monk and Graduate Assistant Megan Rogers is bringing me there to do this workshop. So for more information about that, you can go to lynn-rosen-sdsu.eventbrite.com. Yeah, or if you have trouble registering for the conference, you could contact me.
Yeah, and I'll be sure to link those and the Reauthoring Teaching workshop, the longer one that you're doing as well. That's great. Okay, Lynn, I want to say thank you. That was wonderful and very informative. And I just want to say thank you for making the time. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, take care. All right, that's our show. And I hope if you like what you heard, you will reach out to Lynn, maybe participate in her in-person workshop or actually very easily in her online workshop with Reauthoring Teaching. The links are in the show notes. Please go get the info. Yeah. And so come find us on social media. The Radical Therapist is on Instagram. The Rad Therapist on Twitter. The Radical Therapist on Facebook. And you can always email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. I do like receiving your emails. So don't be shy. And please spread the word. Share this podcast with somebody, a colleague, a fellow student, a fellow professor, a fellow whatever you think might get some value out of it. And that would be very much appreciated. And as always, I'm trying to, I understand the more reviews we get on iTunes, the more we can get in front of people. And I want to get these voices in front of as many people as we can. So please go while you're on your device currently, go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That would be much appreciated. So we'll be back soon with another episode. As always, I'm Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.